This is the Pop Medic Podcast for August 19th, 2015. We're right in the middle of the dreaded dog days of summer, so that means that obviously we'll be talking about...
Woof woof.
That's right, astronomy!
Woof woof.
This is the Pop Money Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I'm Brian, and joining me today are...
Amanda.
Crystal.
I'm just Bill.
Okay, you caught us.
I'm so confused. Wow. We must be star-crossed.
This, you know, I didn't know Amanda could talk so deep.
I have a cold. Okay, so I'm not really Brian. This week we are recording from Nashville's favorite Pedal Tavern, going up and down Broadway in the hot August sunshine. Unfortunately, ever since Pedalgate last spring, Brian's doctors don't really want him near things with finger pedals, so he's going to sit this week out.
No flowers.
No.
This may be the best one.
Hopefully he'll come back next week safe and sound.
And he hates IPAs too, so it's...
So it works out for everyone.
I think.
We will be recording in impromptu locations around downtown Nashville while the children's department at the main library is being renovated. So, this week we are all about astronomy. Why, you're probably asking in your brilliant heads. Well, the dog days of summer are referred to as such, not because they're hot like dogs, but because the dog star can be seen in the beautiful night sky. Now, I have some fun facts to share with you about the celestial body, because the Pop Medic Podcast isn't just about entertainment. We expect learning as well. Yep. There may be a quiz later.
There will be a quiz.
The answer to number two is B. Okay, fun facts. Here we go.
I'm getting a smiley face on my paper.
That's right. Smiley face for Jeremy.
What is the sun?
Number one, the dog star is also known as Sirius, which is derived from...
You're joking.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Which You're is, joking.
It's derived from the Greek word Sirios, which means scorcher. And it is the brightest star in the Canis Majoris system. Canis Majoris is Latin for what? Go.
Big dog.
Big dog.
Big dog.
Hence the dog star.
You can't run the big dog, get off the porch.
Much like a racist t-shirt company in the 90s.
Much like the same t-shirt company that my parents were like, hey, that says Star Wars, but it's dogs. Let's buy it for Jeremy. Yeah. And then we'll go
my parents bought it for me because they're very fond of, you know, they had sizes ranging from, I believe, large to 5X. Maybe 6.
Yeah.
Not that I was 5X gang, but...
Okay, fun fact number two.
Small moons orbited me. That's the episode.
Was it a planet? That's a question for later.
All
right, number two. In Harry Potter, his godfather was named Sirius, and he turned into a...
Scorcher.
Great big dog.
Oh.
That's so it was not just a clever name.
That's wow. Pretty cool.
And this is my favorite fun fact is number three. In the 1990s, Keanu Reeves was in a band called Dogstar.
That's true.
And they covered the Carpenters' hit Superstar.
Whoa.
So
Keanu Reeves has petted a big dog at some point.
I'll take your word for it.
I assume.
Station.
Okay. Now that your minds are totally blown, you are prepared to be astounded by astronomy.
Yeah. All right. Sort of.
Sort of.
Kind of.
More of it.
Okay, I'm going to talk about the 1984 movie Starman, starring Jeff Bridges and Karen Allen, directed by John Carpenter. But first, a little trivia. Columbia Pictures produced Starman, but they turned down another movie which dealt with an alien coming to Earth because they thought Starman was a better vehicle. What was the movie they turned down?
Superman?
No.
Star Wars.
No.
Oh. Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
No. E.T.
Oh!
Wow.
We should have done that.
They're kicking themselves now.
Which at the time became the largest money maker
yeah.
ever.
Yeah.
So,
and the worst
game
of all time.
I am here to praise Starman. It has been over 25 years, but I prefer Starman to E.T. I'm a little different. I know,
In 1977, Voyager 2 was launched into space to the outermost regions of the universe. It carried an invitation in all languages for alien life forms to visit our planet. Someone, somewhere, listened and accepted our invitation. Get ready. Someone is coming. Someone like no one she has ever known before.
Can you clone a living organism from the hair of a dead man?
We're hypothesizing a technology that's probably 100,000 years ahead of us.
He has powers we cannot imagine, and the face and touch of the man she loved.
I send greetings.
What's the matter with you?
How much English do you understand?
I understand greetings in 54 planet Earth languages.
Do you seriously expect me to tell present that an alien has landed, assumed the identity of a dead house painter, and is presently out tooling around the countryside in a hopped-up 1977 Mustang?
You're not from around here, are you?
Think of what it would mean to talk to a being from a civilization like that. Think of what we could learn.
Understand, there isn't much time, please. He doesn't want to hurt anybody. Can't you just leave him alone?
What the hell ever happened to good manners? We invited him here.
So far to come, so much to do, so little time to fall in love. Look up. Company's coming. John Carpenter's Star Man.
First off, has a great performance by Jeff Bridges as the Star Man. Jeff Bridges had three young daughters at the time, and he would observe them to see how they would adjust to the new world. So he just followed their lead and put that into the movie. It's interesting to note that Star Man was meant to be a vehicle for Karen Allen. She was fresh off her hit of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and going to be the next big thing. Yeah. However, Jeff Bridges' bold interpretation had all the critics talking, and he got an Oscar nomination to boot. That's pretty good for a science fiction film. Also, another thing I like about Starman is three legends in the makeup effects worked on it. Rick Baker, Dick Smith, and Stan Winston did this incredible makeup effect in which you see the Starman transform right before your eyes. It impressed my father so much, he talked about it for several months later. He was just blown away by this.
Wow.
And also an interesting to note that a lot of Starman was filmed right here in Tennessee. Even though the movie does not take place in Tennessee, good old incentives. Also to note, there's this scene in the movie where a gasoline tanker explodes, and they filmed that here in Tennessee, and a friend of my mother's at work said they filmed that scene last night, and it almost thought she thought the house was going to explode. It was that loud and sound.
Wow.
At the time, Starman was made fun by comics. David Letterman even stated it's about that alien that comes to Earth and makes a baby. Well, it's much more than that. It's good and bad in humans. As the alien said it best, you are at your best when things are at their worst. It's directed by John Carpenter, who directed Halloween and other horror films. But he was offered to this. It's kind of a strange thing, but he wanted to direct it. And they offered it to him because he kind of wanted to break away from horror to show that he could do something else. And he was very intrigued that it's essentially a road picture. So he thought, he was thinking he was going to be doing so. And he did accomplish Clark Gable and a famous Myrna Loy, something of that age.
He didn't write it?
No, he did not write it. Bruce Evans and Raylon Gideon wrote it.
Did he do the soundtrack?
Jack Nitzsche did the soundtrack.
That's cool.
And a great score he wrote for that. Another thing, also Dean Reisner, a Hollywood screenwriter, John Carpenter wanted him to get credit for it because he did a major rewrite and helped the movie a lot. Yeah. But he didn't get one because of right of guild arbitrations or something.
Yeah, Writers Guild has very strict rules.
But at the end, John Carpenter gave him his own credit at the end, thanks special participation of Dean Reisner. And it's kind of odd because Dean Reisner's probably most famous for, like, Dirty Harry. He's known for writing Charlie Varick.
Oh, cool.
Did a major rewrite on that. So he was essentially noted to working on these turf guy pictures. Anyway, just please check out Starman. It's I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by it these 25 years or more later.
I had a strong memory of seeing that movie or thinking that I had seen that movie when I was what year did it come out?
84.
84, so that's
I believe the trailer 30. Was in the end of the Ghostbusters tape.
Maybe, okay.
Because I remember seeing that trailer a lot, but I never actually seen the movie.
And it was the same year, too.
Yeah.
I was 4 when that came out, and so I could have seen it. I mean, there was not, I don't know if there's anything inappropriate for children, but somehow I remember thinking, like, I love this movie, but I don't remember anything about it. But for some reason, I thought I loved it. Maybe it was just like I saw the box in the video store, and I liked the box a lot.
Isn't Starman a DC hero?
Starman is a DC hero. It's also a David Bowie song.
But unrelated to the movie.
Totally. There was a star, I think he was like a golden age superhero from the 40s.
Before we go down that rabbit hole.
Legends! No. I'm not going to talk about comics this week.
Aww.
It's funny that you mentioned Dogstar in the opening, because I'm actually going to talk about Dogstar. We're going to talk about their complete discography. This is Keanu Reeves' underrated band from the 90s. Movie stars have had rock star ambitions as long as the genres have been around. So, you know, you can kind of roll your eyes if you hear someone mentioning this band. But believe me, they possess a power and a majesty that puts stuff like Bruce Willis's Return of Bruno and Don Johnson's Heartbeat to shame. Now,
what about Russell Crowe's 20-odd feet of grunts?
Oh, that's true. You're right. Oh, and actually, I'm reading my notes here. I'm wrong. This is not our opposite day show. Dogstar blows. So
what?
We do have one of their tracks.
Let me
here. I was going to tease you.
On Freegal. I think. I'm sorry.
You know, I was good that I was not the only one with crappy music taste.
Let me just mark through this real fast.
I was just waiting to see where it went before I got involved.
Yeah, I was going to wait till the end.
For all you listeners, he did mark.
I've completely marked through this. Yeah. I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know how I was keeping up that charade.
Pardon me, would you have any gray poupon?
Personal snob card. Deception card.
That was sneaky.
Oh, well, yeah. That's an unlabeled card.
I can
be
see that one coming.
It's my chaotic neutral card. Take up some more time. If you don't skip over the segments of this show featuring my voice, you've probably heard me talking about
comic books.
Yeah, you've probably heard me say that I suffer from superhero movie fatigue. This is a horrible condition because it's crazy to me that the world I imagined as a 12-year-old, a world in which people were making cool superhero movies with cool special effects, is here and it's thriving. And now there's going to be a whole bunch of new Star Wars movies, and I don't know if my nerd heart and my skeptic brain can take it. So I'm gonna get cosmic this week. For all the successes of superhero movies, there have been some notable failures, and the Fantastic Four films are probably sitting at the top of that pile. There have been 4 films made, though the first was actually made not even to be released. It was just to secure the rights, so it sits in a vault. Sometimes it streams online.
There are some bootlegs available at cons. Yes. I've watched one through that.
Yes.
It's the Doctor Doom is completely hard. You can't understand a word he says. It's a highlight of the film.
I watched the very end of it yesterday, and at the end, the spoiler alert, Mr. Fantastic and the Invisible Woman get married, and they're driving away in a limo, and his arm is sticking out of the top, and it's waving like one of those things that waves outside of a car dealership, you know?
Mm.
Ridiculous. So, anyway, I'm not sure why the Fantastic Four haven't translated well to the big screen, but if there are any big name directors listening, I got a pitch if you're interested in hearing it. What I am sure of is that they have squandered 2 of the coolest characters in the entire canon, the Silver Surfer and Galactus. they spend time in outer space, and that is my spin for this episode.
Yeah, I was wondering where that...
thank you.
We even gave you Starman a minute ago.
I was scrambling. I put all my money on Dogstar, and I came up Johnny Mnemonic. So
Philip Dick got him in. I like it.
Thank you. These two.
So mentioned whatever that romantic comedy he did with
The Lake House.
Yeah,
it was a comedy, wasn't it? Yeah. Whoa, I know Kung Fu. That's the easy road. The Silver Surfer and Galactus first appeared way back in Fantastic Four number 48 in March 1966. But if you saw Rise of the Silver Surfer, then you probably think that was the second Fantastic Four movie. If you saw that movie, you probably think Galactus is a big cloud that eats planets, but that is ridiculous. Galactus is a gigantic guy in purple armor who eats planets. He is not a cloud. He is a gigantic man in purple armor.
It is great. And a skirt.
Yeah, he also wears a skirt.
It's a kilt.
It's a kilt.
All right.
Get in my belly. It's going to go for all the low-hanging fruit. Exactly. The Silver Surfer is his herald, a cosmic servant who scours the galaxy looking for sustenance for his master's hunger. Now, you can read in the collection Silver Surfer, When Calls Galactus, you can mix up your syntax, you can read that book. It features the Fantastic Four's original encounters with Galactus and the Silver Surfer, plus more of the Surfer's adventures after he, spoiler alert, helps the Fantastic Four defeat Galactus and stop him from eating Earth.
Ultimate Nullifier.
Yes.
Spoiler alert.
Yes. These reprints sort of lack some of the power of the original printed page, but it's still worth checking out, because this is the beginning of writer Stan Lee and artist Jack Kirby's peak together, back when they were halfway through their amazing 102-issue run on Fantastic Four. If you can forget for a moment about Stan Lee's credit hogging and Jack Kirby getting financially screwed by one Marvel corporate master after another, you may just enjoy some of the finest comics of the Silver Age, which was named... because it came after the Golden Age, not because the Silver Surfer was all that popular. The Silver Surfer has long been a focal point for Marvel's cosmic comics, popping up throughout the galaxy in various titles and even starring in a few series of his own. He'd been kind of on the back burner for a while, but there was a new series that came out in 2014 by writer Dan Slott and artist Michael Allred. Slott injected some humor into a character who, in the hands of a lot of writers, could just sort of be a little stoic and self-serious, pondering the mysteries of the universe from atop his surfboard.
My board.
Yes.
One of my favorite lines in comic books is when he screams, you know, and the surfboard comes.
There's a lot of that in this series where, like, the board has, like, kind of a personality almost.
Really?
Yeah. And,
that's kind of amazing.
Like, they look at the Silver Surfer and his this woman that's going with him throughout the galaxy. They'll look into the board, and the board reflects back at them, but, like, is, like... not an exact reflection. It's like sort of what it's thinking of. It's kind of silly, but it's fun, you know. Dan Slott kind of borrowed from Doctor Who by introducing a female companion who sort of enforces this patriarchal dynamic or whatever, Brian. But it gives the human audience someone to relate to. And Michael Allred's art steals the show. If you don't know his work, you could check out his creator-owned character Madman, his work on iZombie, which has made an appearance on the podcast many times before, Ecstatics, and several other things. Anything with his name on it is worth a look. There are two volumes of this series. The first is New Dawn, and the second is Worlds Apart. And they're both better than anything Joe Satriani has ever done.
Serving with the Alien is amazing. I'm throwing down my whatever snob.
Don't want to bring me down?
Get wet, yeah, that thing.
Wow.
That song is amazing. My dad used to just play it a bunch. only listener, along with Gary from Perth.
My dad also was a Joe Satriani fan, saw G3, played Surfing with the Alien, and I was like, hey, that has a Silver Surfer on it. Oh, I hate this.
What's... Oh, you're not gonna like my fancy segment.
I brought this up before very briefly that the Silver Surfer had this in the 60s, had this great
following. Oh yeah, rate, yeah.
You know, that was in that Stan Lee documentary.
Yeah, he was like, it was like,
really?
Stan Lee was like, he insisted on only him writing, and he wrote most of the stuff anyway, but by the time the Surfer came around, like Roy Thomas and some other people were doing stuff, and like he was like, no, only I write him, and he sort of used it as a vehicle for like expounding, like it was like mystical 60s kind of new agey freedom and personal reflection.
You don't see that from Stan Lee, you know?
No, not at all.
And
hey kids,
Excelsior.
You know, I thought I'd also just bring up, because you know, again, the only things I care about.
Fantastic Four. It's a stupid question.
Yeah, I'm sure he's there somewhere. That was the third cartoon in the 90s that Fox did. That was Spider-Man, or X-Men, and then Spider-Man, and then Silver Surfer for about 8 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It got canceled because only I watched it. Okay.
Well, that's true, because I didn't even know that. It sounded quite cool.
I knew it was around, but I think I was too busy trying to get...
That's
not true. That's what
I was getting
that.
Home watching cartoons in high school. Yeah. Skipping.
Should I play my Don't Mean to Bring You Down card now?
Don't bring me down! Somebody's bringing you down, Jeremy, but you didn't have a chance.
Normal kids went to prom. I watched Red Sonja on Monster Vision.
That's a good movie.
Jamal Briggs. Wow. That's my hero.
You could have invited me. We'd pop some corn.
That'd be awesome.
If anyone
here knew who Jamal Briggs was, Bill.
Oh, I knew. I got to go to prom because I was such a good friend.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh,
you'd be so much fun. Oh, yeah? Guess what? I'm 17 and I'm bitter.
Did you buy her a flower?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, see, you are fun.
I went to my senior prom by myself.
Stag.
Is it Stag?
Yeah. Stag, yeah.
Yeah.
I skipped both of them because Monster Vision was on.
Priorities, you know.
My hero.
So, anyway. Hey gang, last night I was truly seeing stars. The red stars on some KMFDM logos. Oh, the ultra heavy beat. Kick my butt. Yes, last night was that concert I warned you guys about, and boy did I have a fun time. And I'm really paying for that fun time this morning. My legs still ache, I slept for 3 hours, and I'm worried that my wariness in regards to earplugs is destroying my hearing.
It'll get you.
So... in other words, I may be a bit more loony than usual today. See, loony, lunatic, the moon, you see. Good segue, me. I read that in my notes. I told you I'd be a little loony. Meta, you know. I've talked before about my love of alternate histories. This is where an author spends an entire book on an idea like, what if the South had won the Civil War? What if the Nazis won World War II? Or, you know, et cetera.
Do you have any positive examples?
But for some reason that I've never been able to deduce, when you publish a what-if-style nonfiction piece, it is called a counterfactual.
Ooh.
I don't know why. You can't just call it alternate histories. I guess
they want the finger quip.
It's why change? Why? Well, why can't you just call it alternate histories?
Because it suggests that because
I'm a professor, an academic, I'm better than you.
Well, no, it makes sense because an alternate history sort of
is fictional.
That suggests fiction to me. Maybe because it typically is, but counterfactual. Well, you're I would say counter canonical.
Snap car!
Pardon me, would you have any gray poupon?
Your sound part's gonna break today.
Yeah, I know. Oh, that's like the third one. Well, he did do the deception card.
That's true.
You know, it has like a question mark on it, and it could mean either
one. It's like the Riddler. Riddle me this!
When is a door not a door?
That's exactly
Batman.
What I was gonna say. Wow.
That's the only riddle that ever comes to my mind. That and why is a raven like a writing desk? I heard a really good answer for that.
What is
a raven like a writing desk?
I actually heard a good answer for that because you know Lewis Carroll never gave one.
Okay.
Because Poe wrote on both.
Oh.
Good one. I I can't take credit. Anyway.
Good segue, you, Mike.
Good segue, me. One early counterfactual book that I read is called What If the Moon Didn't Exist? Voyages to Earth That Voyages to Earth That Might Not Have Been by Neil F. Commons. In the early 90s, Commons was, and he still is, a professor of physics at the University of Maine. He was told by a colleague that science educators keep using the same boring old techniques in teaching their students, and he challenged Commons to think outside the box. At home, his young son had begun peppering him and his wife with annoying what-if questions. Commons thought that it would be a neat experiment to think of different kinds of, like, astronomical what-if type scenarios, you know. So, and they, let's say, like in the eponymous essay of the book, you know, what if the moon didn't exist? He quickly learned that the Earth without a moon would be a very different place indeed. The moon's gravitational force in the early days of the solar system slowed down the rotation of the Earth. And without it, a day would last only 8 hours. If life evolved, it would have a completely different biological clock and or metabolism to compensate. And since the Earth would be spinning much faster, it would also be much windier, like, as in, like, you know, 30 miles an hour wind at all times, hurricane force gales.
There are some days that'd be okay with that.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's been pretty hot out.
Never see a skyscraper again, but it'd be really cool. So the quick metabolized life would also be smaller and closer to the ground, as I recall in the book he was talking about, like, you know, like, life would have to have, like, claws to, like, move along the ground because they would get blown away. There are some other cool essays, too. The next one in the book is devoted to if the sun, moon are closer to the Earth. Spoiler alert, instead of no gravitational pull, there's way too much. There's an essay devoted to if a black hole passed through the Earth, which is pretty cool. I mean, if I recall correctly, they depend on the size of the black hole because there theoretically can be black holes as small as a nickel. So, a nickel-sized black hole. Pretty good for the Earth, you know. If it's as big as the Earth, we're doomed. You know, go to the event horizon. The writing style is clear and easy to read. I remember really enjoying it when I was a high schooler who didn't read very much nonfiction, and I read it from beginning to end very quickly. Some of it was still stuck with me decades later. The science holds up, and the book has been adapted into TV, radio, and planetarium shows. Commons also wrote a follow-up book called What If the Earth Had Two Moons and Nine Other Thought-Provoking Speculations on the Solar System, which I suddenly just recalled I did not look up to, which we have. So you can cut this out later, Brian, if we don't have it. But I haven't read it yet. That's on my wish list. It's at my house. Good stuff. Moon pun. What do you have?
Moon pie.
Did you guys see that? Did you see yesterday that the universe is dying?
To me, my boy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what they said. And I was like, duh.
Bummer.
Wow. Entropy sucks, dude.
Slowly. It said... It's
yeah, 400 billion years, it might die.
It said it's lived a long life.
I'll be here.
And it's essentially flopped down on the couch and pulled a blanket up to its neck and is slowly dying.
So we're comfy then.
Like, yeah.
I can watch movies.
We're
going to
die at home. You know, it's going to be a peaceful death, hopefully. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's called hospice. It'll be fine.
Exactly.
Okay, so I am talking about a nonfiction book, too, but mine actually did happen, probably to the regret of some people.
What?
I know.
Counterfactual.
No, mine is actually factual. Oh. Just factual.
Just the factual.
I have always been a sky watcher, but I admit that it's probably more for weather purposes than to view celestial bodies. I think the only things in the sky I can name are the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper. And without seeing them next to each other, I can't really tell you which was which. You know, that's Odd Dipper.
Odd Dipper.
So a couple of
one
years
of two
ago...
Dippers.
One of two, yes. So a couple of years ago, when we got the news that Pluto was dead, I was sad for, you know, like 3.4 seconds, and then I went on with my life.
I'm still in mourning. Poor Pluto.
But why should I even care about a planet a billion gazillion miles away? Not a planet. Not anymore.
Oh, I sense a feature of correction where, like, Brian tells us the exact distance to Pluto.
I rounded up. So in his 2011 book, How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming, Mike Brown tells the story of the death of a planet. He'd been an astronomer most of his life. But Brown really had the suspicion that there was this planetary life out beyond Pluto. Pluto was discovered in 1930, so it hasn't even been a part of the solar system for that long. So Mike Brown, he set out to find it, and he even bet his coworkers, he works at Caltech, he bet them like 5 bottles of champagne that he would find something. And maybe it was a self-fulfilling prophecy, but at the beginning of the new millennium, he did actually find something out past Pluto that was bigger than Pluto.
Whoa.
But was it a planet? Then he found another body, but was it a planet? Then he found another thing that was moving in the sky, and some crazy researchers in Spain tried to steal it and say they found it first.
Whoa.
I know, dirty Spain. But luckily, Mike has some pretty good friends in high places that helped him prove almost definitively that he found it. So, like I said before, I'm not a big fan of astronomy, but I found this book very interesting. They talk a lot about telescopes and how, like, the older telescopes, before they were digitized, they can see an actually bigger picture of the sky, even if it's a little bit not quite as sharp. Yeah. But you have to do all the work in complete darkness. Like, you have to load the slide in the dark and pull the slide out in the dark so you don't wreck the photosensitive plate.
Oh, sure.
So you learn how to do a lot of things by touch. Brown explained how astronomers detect movement. So basically they take two pictures of the sky, like, you know, 20 minutes or 2 days apart. And then, like, they've just flipped back and forth. And then if something in the sky moves, they're like, hey, that's either a planet or it's a blip in the picture.
Either way, I get to name it. Oh, boy.
Yeah, and I think when...
That's an eyelash.
When he first started, like, the first time he ran... Like, so he wrote a computer program to fix that, and he found, like, 37,000 things that moved according to the computer program. Like, one of them was a planet. Oh, so he had to, like, narrow down 36,999 other things that were not.
Wow.
But in August 2005, he actually found something, like I said, that was bigger than Pluto. They named it Xena. Just temporarily, because planets are usually named after mythological figures. There's, like, all these rules for if it's an asteroid, you name it after something, and, like, moons of people are named after poets, and so they have all these rules. So luckily, Xena had a moon, and so they named it
Sorbo.
Gabrielle.
See, I could not. I was blanking on her name.
Yeah,
I
me too.
I was like, and then the other moon is Autolycus or whatever. There was only one. Bruce Campbell.
Bruce Campbell will have to wait till the next planet.
The Chin Nebula.
The Ash Galaxy.
But there was a big controversy. You know, was Xena really a planet? And while we're at it, what exactly was a planet? So they left the answers to these questions up to the International Astronomical Union, or IAU. Brown is not a member of this body, mostly because he's just never completed his paperwork for it. He could be just, you know, I'll get to it someday. So in 2006, the IAU met at its annual meeting to vote on several different resolutions, one of which was the actual definition, trying to define what is a planet, which would then determine the size of our current solar system. And it was, before the panel started, it was expected that the group would vote in Xena along with two other large bodies. I think one was the asteroid Sirius, and there was another moon that someone had talked about that would make our nine-planet solar system 12 planets big. So Brown had set up a press conference with the press back in California where he's at, and the IAU met in Prague, and so they were kind of watching it over Telelink, and he was explaining what they were talking about to the reporters, and the academics loved their tedious debate. They debated everything, especially when you're trying to define something. They were debating footnotes and all that good stuff. So finally, the group determined that the solar system only consisted of 8 major planets, which killed Pluto. Now, technically, Pluto is a dwarf planet.
Yeah, it's king of the dwarf planets.
Yes, but Xena is still out there.
Eris.
Xena is dead. They've actually renamed it to Eris, I think, after some other god.
The goddess of chaos.
Discord, yeah.
Whoa. LV-426.
Sure.
I got your reference. That's right. Game over, man. Game over.
So anyway, Brown thought that the group really made the right decision, even if the wording of the resolution was poor, and even though it meant he didn't get credit for discovering a planet, which would have been really cool. I really liked this book. Even, you know, it was not something I was familiar with, but I learned a lot. It was captivating. Brown is a great storyteller. Even Pluto fans would like it.
It's timely too, because the probe just went past there, and they deplaneted it. And then now they're like, look how fascinating this place is.
Yeah, really.
It's got a big heart on it.
It's like every day. Its surface is really smooth.
Yeah,
they did name a crater after Tombaugh, though, the guy, the discoverer.
Oh, yeah?
And they won the Cthulhu crater thing from Mike.
Cool.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of, like, it seems like there was, like, some Doctor Who craters and stuff, too. But
enough talk. Yeah. I want to live on Cthulhu crater.
Hey guys, what's tickling your fancy? Well, maybe the library has it.
Maybe the library doesn't.
But either way, it's tickling our fancy.
Bill?
It's kind of creepy.
Yeah. It's creepier every week.
It is
week.
The worst when you're the one who gets the name. Like everybody goes, Mike, I just want to like.
Well, that kind of fits in because what I want to talk about is R.L. Stine.
Whoa! Oh, see, we planned it.
Nice. Say cheese and Bill.
If you don't know, if you've been living under a rock and you don't know who R.L. Stine is, he's famous for writing horror books for children, the Goosebumps series, and for young adults, Fear Street series. I never read an R.L. Stine book before, so I just decided to give one of his YA books a try. And the reason I did that, I was just looking for something horror, suspense, and it would be brief and could cut through it, just a nice end of the summer read. And he came through for me. This is the first R.L. Stine book I read. It's called Don't Stay Up Late. It's his latest book, and granted, it's not War and Peace, but that's not what I was looking for.
I'm okay
for.
With that. Yeah, I don't need to read War and Peace.
Well, that's, you know, that's in the Goosebumps series, War and Pieces.
Yeah. I found the book to be a real page-turner and very enjoyable, and I'm reading. I think this one's geared more to adults, and I'm about finished with it. It's called Eye Candy by R.L. Stine.
He's got some adult novels, too.
I need to look into those because I do. He has a nice style that I like. He has a great sense of pace. Good summer reads. So check out Don't Stay Up Late by R.L. Stine.
He's there's a Goosebumps movie that's coming out. Yeah. Jack Black plays.
I heard that there was a Goosebumps movie.
And I told Chris that was kind of one of the reasons I thought, you know, I've seen his books all the time.
Yeah, they're hugely popular.
And I just thought, well, I'll read one. And one of the reasons why was because of that movie. Yeah. And I think it's kind of a neat, interesting idea. Jack Black playing R.L. Stine. There's the demons of all his books are coming alive.
Yeah.
There's some like comic adaptations of his stories and stuff too. There's some really good artists and stuff that did the work. We have them, I think, all in the juvenile section, but they were probably around when I probably should have been reading them, but I was probably reading Stephen King books at that point.
Yes, we were roughly the same age, and yeah, I remember I was watching Tales from the Crypt when Goosebumps was out, and it's like, I think I'll stick with Tales from the Crypt.
I've seen Friday the 13th like 400 times,
Nightmare on Elm Street, I don't need your... Although, my sister was really big on them, and I really liked the titles of them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're Night of the Living Dummy, you're Sage Cheese and Die.
Yeah. I hope that my son won't read them, maybe. So I'll just be like, here, let me know. Talk to me now, please. Is it my turn?
I suppose. Sure.
Jeremy.
Sorry.
What's tickling your fancy?
Tickling my fancy this week is not a comic book, but a book about comic books. In my other life where I talk about things that I like, I write reviews for a website, book reviews for a website. And I don't get paid, so I can talk about it, I think, maybe? I don't know. Anyway, who cares? So, a book that I got to review is a book called The Incredible Herb Trimpey from Tomorrow's Publishing. This is a series of interviews with comics artist Herb Trimpey, who passed away earlier this year. He did an 8-year stint on The Incredible Hulk back in the late 60s and early 70s. And his name is maybe not as well known as some of his contemporaries. He was kind of a go-to guy in the Marvel bullpen of old, doing fill-in stories, inking other artists' work, and then he even started out at the company running the company's photostat machine, which was a precursor to the copier. Throughout his career, he didn't like doing superhero books, but he did a lot of war comics, and so after the Hulk, he did a lot of war comics, and also worked on a lot of licensed comics for Marvel, including G.I. Joe, Transformers, Shogun Warriors, Godzilla, and a bunch of other stuff like that. This book has interviews with comics luminaries like Joe Sinnott and Sal Buscema and Roy Thomas and John Romita and many others who you probably haven't heard of. The world of comics publishing in the 60s and 70s is really fascinating to me because these were all like really amazing artists who were really trained, but like they were just kind of working, like hard-working dudes and ladies. They were hustling, churning out work, supporting their families, like kind of making okay money, and despite getting screwed over by the companies, and is a very fascinating world. So I enjoy this book.
Mark?
Sorry, gang. Books and movies have not been kind of this week, so it's back to music. I don't know about you, but I digs me some surf rock. Yeah, your Beach Boys, your Dick Dales, your The Ventures. This week I thought I'd recommend two songs available through the library that will get some sand between your ears instead of your toes.
Oh!
You.
That actually sounds like a negative.
I felt pretty good for that one. I don't know. But again, movie today. First, there's a cover of the Ventures classic Pipeline, done by Dick Dale and Stevie Ray Vaughan.
SRV.
Soundtrack, which I believe young Jeremy here recommended.
That's right.
Many moons ago.
They're in the movie together.
Yeah, which is kind of awesome. Is it still on Hoopla?
As far as I know, that's where I watched it.
I'll have to look that up. I remember liking it a lot.
It's pretty good.
As a young lad.
It's better than it has any right to be.
You know, I remember Pee Wee Herman's in it. And
yeah.
You had me at Pee Wee Herman.
Frankie and Annette.
It's spit take.
Whoa.
The word of today is
loony.
Loony. Originally available on the Back to the Beach soundtrack, is also on Freegold off of the Stevie Ray Vaughan album Solos, Sessions, and Encores. It is honestly an amazing song and reminds me I should really try out some more Stevie Ray Vaughan. I don't know, I just picture, like, Dad showing me it as a kid, and I'm all like, can we get back to Joe Satriani? Next up, I thought I would recommend all-girl surf rock band from California called La Luz. I first heard about them from a review on the Onion AV Club recently. It's really good. Their latest CD with the delightful name Weirdo Shrine is available on Hoopla. Might I recommend a song called You Disappear? Here at the 21st century. The music industry is dead. Mom, let's do the music industry. What have you got, Amanda?
Well, I don't have a thing this week. I have an experience. My father-in-law was in town this week, this weekend, and he decided that we should go bowling on Saturday.
Yeah.
On Sunday. It was
cool,
Sunday.
Cool.
So I grew up bowling. You can't be in my family and not be a bowler.
Awesome.
I used to be in a league when I was little. And
what?
So, you know, it's probably been 15.
Wow,
it's
cool.
Probably been 15 years since I've officially bowled.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, okay, well, this will be fun.
Like,
so
crush him and do, like, straight 300s and stuff.
No. So we went down to the Franklin Family Fun Center just off of 96 in Franklin and got our shoes and found a ball and started bowling. And the first game, I completely was horrible.
Oh, no.
It took me three different bowling balls until I finally got to the point. Because, like, the ones I had were too heavy, and I have really skinny fingers, so they kept falling out of the thumb hole, and I kept dropping it in my
feet. It's hard finding the right
ball.
Yeah, so I only got a 69 the first game, which was appropriate, but, you know. But then I found a good ball. And the second game, I bowled a 1-5.
Whoa!
Yeah.
So nice. I was like, I knew how to bowl.
That's a vast improvement.
Yeah.
So, and then the last game, I got 121 because I was tired. But yeah. And my father actually won the last two games, which was fine because he was the one that wanted to do it. So he had to mark in the last frame, the 10th frame of the second game to beat me. So I gave him a run for his money that game, but the last game I was dead. So anyway, so then I woke up Monday morning and I could not move.
Whoa.
I was so sore.
Is that what the bandage on your finger?
Yeah,
that's
like,
there's a bandage on her finger.
Yeah, I have no skin on my thumb. Like, I have rubbed all the skin off my thumb because that's normal.
Yeah.
And then, like, I have a blister on the side of my finger that kept hitting yesterday, so it popped
wow.
open and got.
Whoa.
So, I mean, like, I really sacrificed my body for this family hey. Experience.
We'll be right back.
Now, I was going to say that there were no corrections because, like Mary Poppins, the Pop Medic podcast is practically perfect in every way. Then I talked to Brian. He told me that I never mentioned the name of the Japanese cleaning lady, and I kind of did it on purpose, but just in case you are interested, her name is Marie Kondo, and her book is called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, The Japanese Art of Decluttering and Organizing. Ooh. So there you go. Nice. If you're excited.
That cleans up some confusion.
Yes. And apparently we have no other corrections because we really are awesome. So for more information about cleaning and awesomeness, go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
All righty, next week, it's the end.
This is the end.
Of summer.
My only friend.
I was wondering what Lightning's going to sing this week. The killer awoke before dawn. He put his boots on.
It's the Mike Karaoke the Hour. Right brought to you by Nashville Public Library.
And he walked on down the hall.
Just another moment. Please.
It is time.
I love you.
Galactus, take me with him. Take me with him.
I will never forget you, Shalabal.
Norin.
To perform your task as my herald, Norin Rad, you must become far more than merely a man. I bestow upon you a portion of my own power cosmic. You shall absorb boundless strength from the cosmos itself, needing no food to eat, no water to drink, no air to breathe. You shall be able to transmute the elements and to heal others as well as yourself. Cosmic bolts of awesome power shall be yours to hurl. And neither the frigid cold of the deepest space, nor the blazing heat of the brightest star shall harm your shielded body. Most importantly, I shall give you the means to travel faster than the fastest starship, so you may soar to the ends of the universe and beyond. Norin Rad exists no more. You are newborn, my herald. Even your mind is a new page on which I shall write. Arise!
Master, I am ready to serve.
Then go, my Silver Surfer. The spaceways beckon, and the great hunger is upon me once more.
To me, my boy.
Behold the universe. Incredibly complex, yet wonderfully simple.